Hello and welcome to Spoilers, this first introduction to the play The Life and Death of Jack Straw. Following are some introductory notes and a plain text recording of the dialogue, a plain text being the first cut edit of our full cast audio recording. It has all the text, but no SFX, no Foley, and it's the edit we use to hunt out textual errors, retakes, or cuts. So it's not perfect, and we may change the take and the text for the final thing. If you want to just enjoy our production, stop listening now and wait for the release. Or if you're listening in the future, look for the full cast episode further up the podcast list. Seriously, this is an exercise that some listeners won't enjoy. If it ain't for you, move on. But if you're still listening, let's enter spoiler land. Welcome to the spoilers for Jack Straw, Act 1, Scene 4. We've had two scenes from the Rebels as the sparks fly and the rebellion really gets going. And now we're going to close Act 1 with the second scene from the Gentry. We met some fairly unimportant characters last time, some throat clearing from the dramaturg there. Now that the rebellion is up and running, we're getting the big guns. So scene 4 opens with the Queen Mother, the mother of the 14-year-old Richard II. Now, the Queen Mother is the only woman in the play. Now, there may have been more in an uncut version. However, I suspect not. Now, the reason why this might be is that there are a number of parts for young people who might therefore have to be played by the boys of the company who would otherwise specialise in playing women. So Richard II and Nobbs were both boy parts, and maybe even Tom Miller because he's supposed to be very short, though he does feel like an adult role. So it might not be because the author is a bit of a misogynist, it's probably just a structural necessity. Though let's just say he isn't great at writing women, to be fair here, as you will notice in Four Lines' Time. Anyway, enter the Queen Mother, who is talking to the County of Salisbury and a gentleman usher. More on them, or in fact less on them, in a moment. Anyway, enter the Queen Mum with the exposition ball.
This strange, unwelcome, and unhappy news of these unnatural rebels and unjust that threaten wrack unto this wretched land, ay me, affrights my woman's mazed mind.
Oh, yeah, her woman's mazed mind. That might not make the final cut. Anyway, her reaction to the rebellion seems to be primarily emotional rather than practical, so this section is not problematic at all. Anyway, the rebellion.
Burdens my heart and interrupts my sleep, that now, unless some better tidings come unto my son, their true anointed king, my heavy heart, I fear, will break in twain, surcharged with a heavy load of thought.
So, having told us that she is the mother to the king and that she's upset, a man steps up. So in the script, this is Salisbury. This is his only appearance in the play. Literally, this is all he says. So for our production, we gave this dialogue to Sir John Newton because it kind of worked. So Random Lord commends the Queen for caring, so they don't have to.
Madam, your Grace's care in this I much commend. For though your son, my Lord the King, be young, yet he will see so well unto himself that he will make the proudest rebel know what 'tis to move or to displease a king.
He's a good supporter of the king, or pretends to be in front of the king's mother. He does note that the king is very young, but...
And though his looks bewray such lenity, yet at advantage he can use extremity. Your Grace may call to mind that being a king he will not put up any injury, especially of base and common men, which are not worthy but with reverence to look into the princely state of kings.
Base commoners, princely state of kings. I think we know where his loyalty lies. His final words hint at the importance of strategy. We know the king can use force against rebels, but...
A king sometimes will make a show of courtesy, only to fit a following policy. And it may be the king determines so, that he will try before he trust a foe.
Or in other words, a king can lie to his subjects if it gets him what he needs. And that's it from Salisbury. Now for a recurring character, a gentleman usher who sticks with the Queen Mum throughout. The usher is of the opinion that the council of his lords will see them through.
True, madam. For your grace's son, the king, is so well ruled by diverse of his peers, as that I think the proudest foe he hath shall find more work than he will take in hand that seeks the downfall of his majesty.
So power seems to lie more with the council. But, the audience might ask, who allowed this rebellion to come to pass in the first place? Was it the young boy king or his councillors? But the usher has confidence in them.
I hope the council are too wise for that, to suffer rebels in aspiring pride that purpose treason to the prince and state.
And then someone throws the usher the exposition ball to cue in the entrance of the king et al.
In good time, see where my lord the king doth come, accompanied with the bishop and lord treasurer.
So enter the king, bishop, treasurer. Now, we've made the bishop the same person as the archbishop, because he does enter with the Lord Treasurer, so the dream team of Act 1, Scene 2 has reassembled. But the script does say bishop, so it could be someone else. I doubt it. The parts read the same, but, you know, let's leave that option on the table. The boy king is confused. Why would his people do such a thing as rebel?
I marvel much, my lord, what rage it is that moves my people, whom I love so dear, under a show of quarrel, good and just, to rise against us, thus in mutinies, with threatening force against our state and us.
Under a show of quarrel, good and just. He can't see the people having a genuine grievance, and he loves them, ungrateful sods. But like the archbishop before him, perhaps a hint at some schooling in what to say, he says the mutiny must be stopped ASAP.
But if it be, as we are given to know by letters and by credible report, a little spark hath kindled all this fire, which must be quenched with circumspect regard before we feel the violence of the flame.
A little spark to be quenched. The report must have come from the archbishop. It's a direct paraphrase of the earlier text. So feeding into our narrative here of a boy king surrounded by powerful older men telling him what to do. And, of course, his mother.
Meanwhile, sweet lady mother, be content and think their malice shall not injure you. For we have tools to crop and cut them off ere they presume to touch our royal self and thus resolve that you secure shall be.
Again, the token woman must be protected, though I think this actually is quite a telling little speech, because it is the little boy who wants to reassure his mother. You know, she'll be all right. You'll be all right, Mum. It's actually quite sweet in a slightly sickly way. The Queen might have originally have said something back, who knows, but she can't hear because enter a messenger interrupting the moment.
Health and good hap befall your majesty.
Now, this is a bit we have fudged slightly because there's ways this might go that aren't very clear. Because this messenger isn't really the messenger. He's a sort of pre-messenger to announce the arrival of Sir John Morton. I mean, does he bring in a note of, you know, what he's about to say? Because the messenger is then announced by the usher as...
My lord, here is a messenger from Kent that craves access unto your majesty.
So we've fudged it at the moment so that this pre-messenger is actually just Morton very far away in the room. That might change in the edit. So The king says, admit him near. So is near is either bring the messenger, who is Sir John Morton, closer to me because he's very far away.
Admit him near.
Or that he's outside and the sort of messenger, pre-messenger, usher, have fetched him, have gone to fetch him in. Whichever way it turns out, the king muses while Sir John Morton is fetched. So he must be a fair distance away. I'm going with he's in the other room. There's this sort of weird pre-messenger business stuff going on.
Would any gentleman or man of worth be seen in such a cause without offence, both to his God, his country and his prince, except he were enforced thereunto?
So the king thinks this messenger comes from the rebel camp, that he will parley with the rebels, and that might be that. But according to the stage directions, Sir John will enter in a moment, but the Queen Mother knows that it is he who is coming. So, which is why I mentioned maybe the messenger, the pre-messenger, brought in a note which has been read by various parties about what is going to be said. Or there's some cut dialogue. So people sort of know things that they don't really have a reason to know. Anyway, the Queen can't believe Morton would be a rebel.
I cannot think so good a gentleman as is that knight, Sir John Morton, I mean, would entertain so base and vile a thought. Nor can it sink into my woman's head that, were it not for fear or policy, so true a bird would file so fair a nest. But here he comes. Oh, so my longing mind desires to know the tidings he doth bring.
Now, I think the Queen Mother ships Morton, but that's just projection. So, at this point, Sir John officially enters. You may remember that the rebels said they captured his castle at Rochester and his family, so we know he's not on their side.
The Commons of Kent salute your Majesty, and I am made their unhappy messenger. My lord, a crew of rebels are in field, and they have made commotions late in Kent, and drawn your people to a mutiny. And if your grace see not to it in time, your land will come to ruin by their means. Yet may your grace find remedy in time to qualify their pride that thus presume.
Perhaps he is dishevelled, saddle sore, a downtrodden figure, or does his innate stoutness shine through? The play obviously thinks well of him. Big commotion in the room at his news, perhaps? And though Morton speaks to the king, the bishop is the one to respond. No one listens to the king.
Who are the captains of this rebel rout that thus do rise gainst their anointed king? What, be they men of any worth or no? If men of worth, I cannot choose but pity them.
The bishop wants to know the class of rebel they're facing. Class politics all the way. And Morton assures the bishop,
No, my good lord. They be men of no great account, for they be none but tylers, thatchers, millers, and such like, that in their lives did never come in field before this mutiny did call them forth.
Just revolting peasants, my lord, but they have my family.
And for security of my back return upon this message, which I showed the king, they keep my wife and children for a pledge, and hold me out from forth my castle at Rochester, and swore me there to come unto your Majesty, and having told you their minds, I hope your grace will pardon me for all, in that I am enforced thereunto.
Much sympathy and commotion from the unnamed extra character in the scene, the crowd of lords, the extra numeraries. Lots of murmuring and rah, 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 rah. The king speaks sensible business. Having tackled the exposition ball from Morton, he then passes it back.
How many men have they assembled in the field?
I think, my lord, about 20,000 men.
Only 20,000 again. The rebels say 50. Who do we believe? And now Morton gives some advice to the king. Talk to them. Calm them down. You, yourself, the king.
But if your grace would follow my advice, thus would I deal with these rebellious men. I would find time to parley with some of them, and know what in their minds they do intend. For being armed with such treacherous thoughts, they may perform more than your grace expects.
And no one else speaks. The king responds. Go, do so, Sir John. Sir John. Yes, he says Sir John a lot.
With speed return to those unnatural men, and see, Sir John, you greet them thus from us. Tell them that we ourselves will come to them, to understand their meaning and their minds. And tell them, if they have any evil sustained, ourselves will see sufficient recompense. Go, good Sir John, and tell them upon the Thames, ourselves will meet with them there to confer concerning their avail. Do so, Sir John, and kindly recommend us to them all.
And there's an interesting detail here, which is almost hidden away. Upon the Thames, ourselves will meet with them. So the king suggests meeting them on the Thames. Does he mean by the Thames? This will be important in a moment. For now, Morton agrees to take the message to the rebels and does the usual exit arse-licking required of talking to a king.
We shall fulfil your grace's mind in this. And thus I take my congé of your majesty, wishing your grace thrice Nestor's years to reign, to keep your land, and guard your royal train.
Farewell, good knight, and as thou darest, remember them, though they forget themselves.
And I'm telling you, the Queen Mother is hot to trot for Morton. She isn't, but she so could be. And it's not like the actor has much else they can do with the part at this precise moment. She will return later. There are some interesting things to be noted there. Morton has gone. We now have a slightly odd exchange, and I think that some of this is misplaced, and there are more and less dramatic variations on what could happen with this whole scene. It does feel like there's an awful lot of potential business that's been lost or things that have been moved around. But for this specific section, there are three speeches left in the scene: the bishop, the king, and the treasurer. At the very least, I believe the last two speeches are the wrong way round. The scene should end with the king speaking, otherwise it makes no sense dramatically. Though the issue of cuts might change this. A more radical move is to play around with the bishop and the treasurer's speeches and move them maybe even earlier into the text of the play so that there is a live debate about what they do with the rebels when Morton is still in the room, which didn't quite work. I did play around with just moving this text around and as recordings and listening back to how it flowed. I suspect there's more arguing in front of the king going on than we have here. So the plain text version that's following, I have swapped around the last two speeches because I think that is how the scene goes. It makes sense that there is two people semi-arguing or trying to take the credit in front of the king for what they are about to do, and the king closes everything off and moves everyone on to the next scene. Anyway, three speeches in question coming up. The first is the bishop, who's doing a bit of arse-licking.
Your grace herein is very well advised, with resolution fitting your degree. Your grace must show yourself to be a king, and rule like God's vicegerent here on earth. The looks of kings do lend both life and death, and when a king doth set down his decree, his sentence should be irrevocable. Your grace herein hath shown your princely mind, in that you hate to prey on carrion flesh. Such prey befits not kings to prey upon, that may command and countermand their own. I hope, my lord, this message so will prove that public hate will turn to private love. And therefore I say, my lord, you have answered well. The task was given your grace by act of parliament, and you have reason to demand your due.
Then, as originally printed, the king would reply, which we're going to look at here now. The king replies,
my lord, I hope we shall not need to fear to meet those men that thus do threaten us. We will, my lord, tomorrow meet with them, and hear, my lord, what 'tis that they demand.
Which sums up the plan as mentioned. Then he turns to his mother.
Mother, your grace shall need to take no care, for you shall in our Tower of London stay, till we return from Kent to you again. My lord, see everything prepared for us. And, mother, Thus I leave your majesty, you to the tower, and I must hence to Kent.
Which just feels like a closing line. Note his mother doesn't get a response, but also she will pointedly not be in the tower later on. So there's more to discuss on that later. And finally, the speech which I think must live earlier. The last time we will hear any words spoken by the treasurer.
My lord, if so you please, take my advice herein, that speaks in love and duty to your grace. I shall in every matter privilege your majesty and all your lordly train. I mean against your manor of Greenwich town, and so amidst the stream may hover safe. Meanwhile, they send some few and chosen men to give your grace to understand their minds. And thus, my lords, I have adventured to show your majesty my mind herein.
All of these details which were decided earlier, so it's a terrible speech to close the act. It's much more plausible that the last two speeches have got swapped around, but there are any number of issues about how this scene has reached us. The plan to go to Greenwich by boat is not really very clearly expressed, and it is important, and who suggests it and who champions it is a bit messed up. There are a lot of odd party quirks in the King's dialogue. He calls Sir John Sir John a lot, which is a pain because there are two Sir Johns in this play. He also says My Lord a lot, and I wonder if there hasn't been some alteration here, especially if some minor characters who've had lines cut were addressed by name and just were changed to My Lord as a nice straightforward generic. A lot of that is speculation. I mean, the miracle is, and for all the issues with this scene, it works, and there's a lot of interesting material to it. Counselors, his mother, they're all pushing for the king to choose an action, and the action chosen, there's a little bit of a tussle as to who owns that choice. I wondered if the mini discussion after Morton left was moved from earlier. It didn't really fit, but it's an after-the-fact counsellor-led charge to own the narrative. And here the boy king does actually give some definite orders. His mother goes to the safety of the tower, and he will go and meet the rebels at Greenwich. But neither action is actually obeyed. The young king is not really in control of himself or his people. Yet. Next time, Act 2, and the scene everyone remembers. Yes, it's the scene with the goose. After that, we're going to fly through the many short scenes at greater speed. We have been going through quite a lot of this play in perhaps excessive detail, so a little swifter through what follows. If you have any thoughts about my brief breakdown of Act 1, Scene 4, or if you have any disagreements with my thoughts, or if I'm in plain error, let me know. I might re-edit based on your suggestions. Email us at admin@beyondshakespeare.org or give us a buzz on Twitter @beyondshakes. Or you can support our work by becoming a patron. Patrons get to vote for the plays we work on next and get material early. Go to patreon.com/beyondshakespeare and get involved. But that's it from this spoiler part of the episode. The full cast super deluxe edit will be coming anon. But till then, here is the plain text of Act 1, Scene 4, to the life and death of Jack Straw, performed by Haydn McCabe as the Treasurer and Salisbury, Adam Thirkettle as the Bishop, Geir Madland as Sir John Morton, Gillian Horgan as the Queen Mother, Pamela Flanagan as the Usher, and Nemini Stone as Richard II. And I've been your host, Robert Crichton. Enjoy.
This strange, unwelcome, and unhappy news of these unnatural rebels and unjust that threaten wrack unto this wretched land, ay me, affrights my woman's mazed mind, burdens my heart, and interrupts my sleep, that now, unless some better tidings come unto my son, their true anointed king, my heavy heart, I fear, will break in twain. surcharged with a heavy load of thoughts.
Madam, your grace's care in this I much commend. For though your son, my lord the king, be young, yet he will see so well unto himself that he will make the proudest rebel know what 'tis to move or to displease a king. And though his looks bewray such lenity, yet at advantage he can use extremity. Your grace may call to mind that being a king he will not put up any injury, especially of base and common men, which are not worthy but with reverence to look into the princely state of kings. A king sometimes will make a show of courtesy, only to fit a following policy. And it may be the king determines so, that he will try before he trust a foe.
True, madam. For your grace's son, the king, is so well ruled by diverse of his peers, as that I think the proudest foe he hath shall find more work than he will take in hand that seeks the downfall of his majesty. I hope the council are too wise for that, to suffer rebels in aspiring pride that purpose treason to the prince and state. In good time, see where my lord the king doth come, accompanied with the bishop and lord treasurer.
I marvel much, my lords, what rage it is that moves my people, whom I love so dear, under a show of quarrel, good and just, to rise against us, thus in mutinies, with threatening force against our state and us. But if it be, as we are given to know by letters and by credible report, a little spark have kindled all this fire, which must be quenched with circumspect regard before we feel the violence of the flame. Meanwhile, sweet lady mother, be content, and think their malice shall not injure you, for we have tools to crop and cut them off, ere they presume to touch our royal self, and thus resolve that you secure shall be, what hard mishap soever fall to me.
Health and good hap befall your majesty.
My lord, here is a messenger from Kent that craves access unto your majesty.
Admit him near, for we will hear him speak. 'Tis hard when twixt the people and the king such terms of threats and parleys must be had. Would any gentleman or man of worth be seen in such a cause without offence, both to his God, his country and his prince, except he were enforced thereunto?
I cannot think so good a gentleman as is that knight, Sir John Morton, I mean, would entertain so base and vile a thought. Nor can it sink into my woman's head that, were it not for fear or policy, so true a bird would file so fair a nest. But here he comes. Oh, so my longing mind desires to know the tidings he doth bring.
The commons of Kent salute your majesty, and I am made their unhappy messenger. My lord, a crew of rebels are in field, and they have made commotions late in Kent, and drawn your people to a mutiny. And if your grace see not to it in time, your land will come to ruin by their means. Yet may your grace find remedy in time to qualify their pride that thus presume.
Who are the captains of this rebel rout that thus do rise gainst their anointed king? What, be they men of any worth or no? If men of worth, I cannot choose but pity them.
No, my good lord, they be men of no great account. For they be none but tylers, thatchers, millers, and such like, that in their lives did never come in field before this mutiny did call them forth. And for security of my back return upon this message, which I showed the king, they keep my wife and children for a pledge, and hold me out from forth my castle at Rochester, and swore me there to come unto your majesty. And having told you their minds, I hope your grace will pardon me for all, in that I am enforced thereunto.
How many men have they assembled in the field?
I think, my lord, about 20,000 men. But if your grace would follow my advice, thus would I deal with these rebellious men. I would find time to parley with some of them, and know what in their minds they do intend. For being armed with such treacherous thoughts, they may perform more than your grace expects.
With speed return to those unnatural men, and see, Sir John, you greet them thus from us. Tell them that we ourselves will come to them to understand their meaning and their minds. And tell them, if they have any evil sustained, ourselves will see sufficient recompense. Go, good Sir John, and tell them upon the Thames, ourselves will meet with them there to confer concerning their avail. Do so, Sir John, and kindly recommend us to them all.
We shall fulfil your Grace's mind in this. And thus I take my congé of your Majesty, wishing your Grace thrice Nestor's years to reign, to keep your land, and guard your royal train.
Farewell, good knight, and as thou darest, remember them, though they forget themselves.
Your Grace herein is very well advised, with resolution fitting your degree. Your Grace must show yourself to be a king, and rule like God's vicegerent here on earth. The looks of kings do lend both life and death, and when a king doth set down his decree, his sentence should be irrevocable. Your Grace herein hath shown your princely mind, in that you hate to prey on carrion flesh. Such prey befits not kings to prey upon, that may command and countermand their own. I hope, my lord, this message so will prove that public hate will turn to private love. And therefore I say, my lord, you have answered well. The task was given your Grace by Act of Parliament, and you have reason to demand your due.
My lord, if so you please, take my advice herein, that speaks in love and duty to your Grace. I shall in every matter privilege your Majesty and all your lordly train. I mean against your manor of Greenwich town, and so amidst the stream may hover safe. Meanwhile, they send some few and chosen men to give your Grace to understand their minds. And thus, my lords, I have adventured to show your Majesty my mind herein.
My lord, I hope we shall not need to fear to meet those men that thus do threaten us. We will, my lord, tomorrow meet with them and hear, my lord, what 'tis that they demand. Mother, your Grace shall need to take no care, for you shall in our Tower of London stay till we return from Kent to you again. My lord, see everything prepared for us. And, mother, thus I leave your Majesty, you to the Tower, and I must hence to Kent.